Now, Paul Johnston, welcome to the programme. You are Her Majesty's Ambassador to Ireland. So you presented your credentials to Michael D. Higgins on the 8th of October. How have you and your wife Nicola been settling in since then?
Well, thank you very much, Brendan. Both before then and after, we felt very warmly welcomed in Dublin. It's been a strange time to start. It's been a strange year for everyone. So we arrived on the 21st of September, and then we had the 2 week period of restricted movement. So we were essentially in the house, going out for a walk every day, but other than that, in the house. Then we had that brief period when we were at level three, and that was the period during which I presented my credentials. And then for the last, you know, however many weeks, we've been in level five. So we've been back effectively in a very restricted scenario. But I've had the opportunity through SHU technology to meet a lot of Irish ministers and politicians and officials and other people, as well as meeting my own embassy team. And yeah, I've just felt very warmly welcomed, really happy to be here. We love the fact that Dublin is both so near the sea and near so much greenery as well. So we're up Tiknock Hill almost every morning, just trying to get some fresh air and get some exercise, and really longing, like everyone else, longing for a return to normality. And in my case, to get out and about around the country and meet people.
Yeah, because I presume that social distancing in a way is the opposite to pressing the flesh, and that pressing the flesh and diplomacy is what you should be doing now.
It's true. I mean, it's classically a sort of contact sport, if you like. And when I started as ambassador to Sweden, I think in my first few days I was hosting receptions and dinner parties, and we had ministerial visits and all the rest of it. And it feels a bit strange not to be doing that and to be doing everything a bit remotely. So yeah, I'm really keen to get back into, as soon as, you know, public health rules and everything else allows, I'm really keen to get back into to that business of actually meeting people, because you'll know yourself, it's not quite the same having a virtual meeting. It makes all the difference in the world, whether it's a minister or a chief executive or anyone really, to be able just to sort of sit and chat to them more informally. But we have to do what's right, and Ireland's great success in driving down the numbers has been because, you've been following these public health rulings.
Can I ask you a sidebar question there? Mm. You mentioned that you were the ambassador to Sweden for a while. We saw Sweden last week has had shocking numbers of deaths, and having thought that they were investing in phase one in the first wave and that they wouldn't get the second wave, it's not working out well for them. Do you understand the Swedish mentality? As an outsider who spent time there, can you see why they went this direction?
It's a very good question. And they have been, I think they would say themselves, something of an outlier in the way that Europe has done this. Until just a few days ago, they'd allowed much larger gatherings. They hadn't imposed some of the same restrictions. I mean, there are some differences. One of them is, new surveys would suggest that Swedes have a very high acceptance of public authorities, and they don't tend to need restrictions to do things. They just tend to follow guidance. I think also there's a high number of Swedes, particularly in the Stockholm area, who live on their own. So it's not maybe like a southern European setting where you have large extended families all living in the same houses. A lot of them work in IT and services, so they can work remotely anyway. So I think the judgment was probably made for a variety of reasons that the rather strict lockdown that other countries had enforced during the first wave, they chose not to. But as you say, their numbers are now rising. And, I think it's, I don't envy our sort of policymakers, because they're wrestling with economic health, public health, a range of other factors. And I guess the historians 10 or 20 years hence will be able to look at what different countries did and try and evaluate.
Yeah.
But, everyone is, the science is evolving, mass testing, vaccine options, things that we didn't have in the first wave, God willing, are coming now as we're in the second wave. So they've chosen a different path. And I think, it will be difficult to know. I know this is a slightly sort of
diplomatic answer. It's a diplomatic answer. Yeah.
Who took the right path?
Yeah. Yeah. OK. Listen, people will be noticing your accent. I suppose it's not the stereotypical Whitehall old Etonian accent we expect from the UK ambassador. You're from Scotland.
I'm from the southeast of Scotland, Brendan. That's right. From a small market town in the Scottish borders. So big rugby country called Galashiels. My mum and my brother still live there. My mum's lived there all her life. And I grew up there, went to school there, Went to Glasgow's university, so I've lived on the east coast and the west coast of Scotland. So I know something of the rivalries that can occur. But yeah, so
are you from a privileged background?
Gosh, no, not at all. I mean, very much not. My my parents had very ordinary occupations, and I was not at all from the background from which the Foreign Office, you know, traditionally recruited. And that was one of the things that sort of interested me. I saw a documentary about the sort of Foreign Office applications process and was rather sort of, you know, encouraged to see that there was a range of people from a range of different backgrounds, you know, applying. And I knew very little about it. No one that I had grown up with or went to school with or went to university with had had that sort of career. And I'd thought about teaching, and I'd thought about, you know, staying on and doing some academic research. And then this opportunity came up, and, you know, I just found the sort of selection process interesting and the type of work seemed interesting. But no, I mean, when I joined in a group of 15 people, three of them were old Etonians, which is not particularly representative of the population as a whole. Mm-hmm. But one of the big changes I've seen over the last 30 years in the Foreign Office, which is really encouraging, is much more diversity of gender, of ethnic origin, disabled people, people from different socioeconomic backgrounds. And that's very much what the whole of the British Civil Service wants to do, which is to be much more representative of the country as a whole than it was certainly when I joined 30 years ago.
And listen, a lot of people won't envy you your job representing the UK at the moment. Would it be fair to say that UK relationships internationally are a bit strained at the moment?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, I would say that, I mean, I spent 4 years in Brussels before I came to Dublin, through the period of the Brexit referendum and its aftermath. And I think a lot of our European colleagues didn't expect the referendum result, didn't particularly want the referendum result, but respected that that was the decision the British people have taken. It's taken a long time to get to the point that we're at now, which is hopefully on the edge of the final deal. But I think what I found here, albeit largely virtually, but also in the time I spent in Brussels dealing with people from across Europe, you know, a lot of affection in Britain. Clearly, people are struck that we're striking out on a new path.
It's saddened, I would say, a lot of people.
Some people are saddened, yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, what we've said, I know it's a phrase that our ministers have said over and over again, but I think it bears repeating. You know, we're leaving the European Union, but we're not leaving Europe. We want to have really strong relations with Ireland. The Prime Minister and the Taoiseach spoke about this when they met in Belfast in September. We want to maintain and indeed strengthen our relations with European countries. They will be in a different setting because we won't be sitting around European
Because even
Union
if there's a
together.
Deal, it's a very hard Brexit, isn't it? Like it is the hardest that would have been envisaged at the start of all this.
Yeah, I mean, there was clearly a spectrum of options, and the government chose to go for one in which we left the single market and we left the customs union, which clearly has a range of implications. And we're working those through. And part of the reason we have the special Ireland, Northern Ireland protocol is to make sure that the effects of that are worked out in a way that is as smooth as possible and as effective as possible for people and for businesses in Northern Ireland, but in Ireland as well. So, yes, we've chosen a particular form of Brexit, but we're determined both to make a success of it, but also to ensure that our relations with European countries and with the European Union continue to work, you know, in both our interests.
Yeah, it would seem, I would have thought, though, the tone of relationships is maybe not ideal at the moment, is it? Britain's standing in the world is not what it was, though, is it?
I think Britain is still, you know, a big player in Europe and in the world. Before I went to the EU job in Brussels, I was working in NATO, and we played a big role in bringing the NATO nations together in 2016. There were some big differences in the alliance in NATO about how to deal with Russia, for example. And we were the country who were able to bring people together towards a consensus on that. And I spent 3 years in New York in the UN Security Council, where Ireland will be in just a few weeks' time. And always found there that there was great respect for, you know, British diplomacy, British values. That's not to say individual things that we do don't get criticised, but that's the case with lots of countries.
Yeah, like I saw even during the week there, the reneging on the 0.7% promise on foreign aid, you David Cameron out, the Archbishop of Canterbury, and indeed Baroness Sugg, who is the junior minister in the Foreign Office, am I right, in the Foreign
Office?
She
was a junior minister. She resigned last week.
Yeah. And she said, again, this was something else that damaged Britain's standing in the world and Britain's reputation, I suppose, as an international country, you know.
So that was a really difficult decision. And the Foreign Secretary spoke to us about it in an all-staff meeting last week. Yeah, and he said this was not something that any of us wanted to do because we're all proud of our commitment to 0.7%. We are amongst the G7, amongst the world's leading economies. We were the only one to be meeting that 0.7% target. We have temporarily gone down to 0.5%, which is still, I think, four times as much as America does, twice as much as Canada does. But it reflects the fact that our economy has taken a massive hit because of the pandemic. We're borrowing, I think, £400 billion this year. I mean, that's a massive amount of money. Our economy is going to shrink by 11%, its worst reduction in 300 years. So I know it's a cliche, but it's true. Very difficult choices have had to be made. We're putting a massive amount of money into the health service, into vaccines, into things like education. And unfortunately, the choice was made to reduce temporarily the amount of money we're giving to overseas aid, but we're going to spend what we have as effectively as possible. We've merged the Foreign Office and the Development Department precisely so we can get as much impact as possible.
In terms of what you're noticing about the relationship here, I suppose in the broader sense, we probably hit a high a few years back in recent years. We had the Queen over here speaking Irish. And there was a great sense that there was a huge healing, if that's the word, of a lot of what had went on in the past. And then in the last few years around Brexit, you get the sense that certainly, I think the British press, the tone of it, a lot of it kind of possibly blaming Ireland for the fact that the UK didn't get the deal it imagined it would get. And then equally, you'd have to say that over here, I think the tone of how we relate to Britain changed as well, didn't it?
I've seen some articles just in the Irish press in recent days where people are expressing concern about the Anglophobia and things like that. I mean, I think we're coming to a point in the next few weeks where there will be a turning of the page. We'll be leaving the transition period. I think we all hope we'll be leaving with a deal. The relationship will evolve. But I'm struck just thinking about the sort of all the interconnections between Britain and Ireland, not just our shared responsibility as, you know, guarantors of the Belfast Good Friday Agreement towards Northern Ireland, but the hundreds of thousands of people that live in each other's countries, the fact that there are so many things that we can do together in the future, whether it's in relation to science, energy. I mean, I think both of our countries are going to find that our economies and societies have been scarred by the pandemic. We're both going to have to learn lessons about resilience, sustainability. You know, at the end of next year, we'll be hosting the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, my university town. And that's a huge, almost a last chance for the world to stop, you know, uncontrollable climate change, which over time would make the pandemic look like a relatively manageable crisis. So that's a long way of saying that I think, you know, you can have issues of, you know, temporary changes of tone, but I think the underlying shared interests we have are enormous. And I detect, you know, enormous, affinity, you know, in both directions when you look at, you know, our media, our culture. I love the way that Irish people sort of embrace the Premier League as if it was their own thing. Yeah. And I think that's fantastic. And people in the UK, you know, embrace Terry Wogan, embrace Graham Norton. It's that that flow of affinity across the Irish Sea, I think, is something we really need to guard because it's very precious.
Yeah, and look, we'd hope so. And look, negotiations can always be a fractious time. And then when they're done, people can then move on and work together.
So I mean, I did negotiations in the UN, in NATO, in the European Union. And there would be times as negotiators where you really felt very sort of tense and very, you know, cross with each other. And the outside world, you know, to the extent they were interested, would pick up on that. But in the end, you get to a deal and you move on. And that's my strong hope and expectation.
A deal seems far from certain at the moment,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a bit. This is absolutely a typical thing in any negotiation that you can do the, nothing is ever easy, but there's the sort of the more straightforward stuff. And then in the final days, you get into the really sort of crunch issues. And I've done negotiations in the run-up to a NATO summit. and a UN summit when a few days before the leaders were due to arrive, we didn't have agreements on some of the big, difficult issues. And that's where Frost and Barnier are at the moment. But they're meeting intensively over this weekend. And, you know, we've all just got to give them the space and time. And I think it's great that no one really knows what's going on in the so-called submarine or tunnel, because I know as a negotiator, you need to have that space to be able to have a really frank and candid discussion. But, you know, I think both sides know what the other side's interests are. I think there's an overwhelming interest in trying to get to a deal, but it's got to be a deal that works for both sides.
OK, so you're confident, are you?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're confident that Boris Johnson does ultimately want a deal?
I'm sure he wants a deal. I mean, it's got to be a deal that works for the UK, but that's exactly the same on the EU side. And both sides have said essentially the same thing. We both want a deal, but it can't be at any price. So it's absolutely a job of trying to find the sort of the intersections, if you like, where both sides can say, yeah, we've got a deal that works for us. And I would, you know, hope and believe that that is possible.
You mentioned, you used the word smooth earlier about Northern Ireland and the UK and the relationships there, trade relationships and everything. It would seem far from smooth at the moment in terms of, like, we've now had this sausages issue, which seems to be a potentially a big problem, which is that Northern Ireland is now in the EU, and they can't import unprocessed, cool meat, refrigerated, not frozen meat, and Britain is then retaliating. I was wondering, is this what Boris Johnson was afraid of with the Internal Markets Bill? Is this the UK internal market being disrupted by Europe, and is that a serious problem?
So I think the very distinctive thing in the Northern Ireland Protocol that was agreed last year was that you would have, you know, two big things. You'd have Northern Ireland remaining in the so-called customs territory of the United Kingdom. So the United Kingdom would have a single internal market, but also recognising the facts of the all-island economy and, crucially, the desire, the insistence on our part and on the EU's part of having an open border in accordance with the Belfast Good Friday Agreement, that Northern Ireland would follow rules of the EU single market. So it would be in a position where it would be at the sort of intersection of the EU single market and the UK customs territory. Now, that obviously is a very distinctive thing. It's not something the EU has ever done before, but it's a recognition on both sides of the importance we attach to the peace process and peace and stability in Northern Ireland. There's a huge amount to be worked out, as you might imagine. And there's a thing called the Joint Committee, which is the British government and the European Commission, who are working out in tremendous detail how this will work in practice. And we have said, and the Irish government have said, and I've heard Simon Coveney say it both in seminars that he and I have done together and in other settings, that we need to find a way that makes this work, that clearly respects the rules of the single market, but that it also is effective and pragmatic on the ground. Because after all, this is about people and businesses in Northern Ireland who have links both to Ireland but also to the rest of the UK. And I think, you know, the strength and the beauty of the Good Friday Agreement is that it rests on an east-west and a north-south dimension. And I think the way the protocol is implemented...
Do you think it's threatened by the Internal Markets Bill?
No, I think the Internal Markets Bill is designed to deal with one particular contingency which none of us want to see, which is that we don't end up with a trade deal between the UK and the European Union. Therefore, we don't have, in the jargon, a zero tariff, zero quota, a zero quota access between the two markets. And we don't have agreement within the Joint Committee on some of the issues that are still outstanding there. And we could, in that contingency, see a situation in where the sort of the connectivity economically between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK would face unacceptable, you know, trade barriers and bureaucratic barriers. And that's the sort of, that's the scenario which none of us want to see, which the bill was introduced to guard against. But as the Taoiseach have said, and as others have said, if we get the free trade agreement we want, and if we get successful outcomes in the Joint Committee, then that contingency will not arise.
Listen, if we go away from recent history and go to not ancient history, but less recent history, you're here at a kind of a particular time. We had the bloody Sunday commemorations last weekend. I believe you weren't invited to that.
That's right.
Yeah. But Is this a tricky time for you as a diplomat? Are you going to be basically around apologising all the time for? I see you had to you know sounded an apologetic note around the Bloody Sunday. Is this going to be a time of you apologising a lot for things your ancestors perceived to have done?
I put out a statement in response to a request from the newspapers saying that on Bloody Sunday it seemed to me that this was a moment for reflection, for us to look back together on what is clearly a complex and a difficult past, but also to look forward to the future. And I also said that, you know, in thinking about it, I couldn't do any better than echo what the Queen had said, and you mentioned it earlier, Brendan, when she came to Dublin. She said, with the benefit of hindsight, we can all think of things that we would rather had been done differently or not done at all. And I think that's how people should feel on both sides. And I was really impressed by what the president said in his statement at Croke Park, where he said, you know, if you look at the events of that day in their totality, you can understand why people in different communities in different parts of our islands will see them in often starkly different ways. But the important thing is to sort of recognise that there is legitimate perspectives. There's hurt on all sides. I did a virtual visit this week to Belfast and spoke to some people in the Loyalist community who were talking about, you know, the sort of the journey they'd been on since the Good Friday Agreement, and that they now meet up with people who had been on the other side. And clearly they have very distinct interpretations and experiences of the more recent past, the past of the Troubles. Mm. And I said to them, do you have to leave those things at the door? And they said, no, we have to bring them into the room. We have to talk about these things. And I know the president is doing a series of seminars starting next week on sort of the importance of historical memory. Our Secretary of State for Northern Ireland has launched a shared history fund. And I think we just need to be, I think, very conscious of the past, but not sort of bound by the past. And I think if the last year has taught us anything, it's, you know, how precious life is. I had my first experience last night of watching the Toy Show and just seeing those young children who'd been through such a terrible time and their eyes lighting up. That makes you think that, you know, that's what we should be thinking about. It's their people, their future. But, you know, we need to remember the past and be respectful of it.
You see, I wonder, is this why they sent us a Scot at this particular time, that there might be a sense that it was you'd be more emollient on the whole thing?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, it's a very interesting sort of selection process that you go through. I don't know if it's the same in your diplomatic service, but you have to write us a one-page manifesto, which you make your pitch. And I did think that, you know, being a Scot from a sort of, you know, a working class background would be perhaps, as you said in your introduction, a bit different to what Irish people might expect in a British ambassador. So I hope I can confound expectations in a good way.
OK, well, listen, Paul Johnson, British ambassador, thank you very much.
And, thanks, Brendan.
Hopefully now you'll get out and get to press the flesh and do your diplomacy in person.
Very much looking forward to it.
OK, we'll take a break.
Email brendan@rte.ie.